I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Michael Hawley, Managing Director of the Program in American Values and Institutions at Duke University. We're discussing his 2021 book, Natural Law Republicanism, Cicero's Liberal Legacy, from Oxford University Press. Hawley's research focuses on contemporary theories of rhetoric, Roman and early modern political thought, Islamic and Christian political philosophy, modern just war theory, and American political thought.
Hey, well, first of all, Mike Hawley, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Mike, I love the book. It was a great, sweeping, really, I think is the right adjective to use, analysis of Cicero and then Cicero's legacy across the early modern period in the liberal tradition. And, you know, great readings of all the different thinkers and a lot of kind of upending of usual political theory wisdom about the ancients and the moderns, liberalism, republicanism. So we'll get into all this, but, well done on the book. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy that it's done.
Yeah. So, well, okay. So dial us back. So to go back to the beginning here of the book, what do you take to be, or, you know, what was the motivation for writing the book in the first place?
Yeah. So to be honest, I sort of stumbled into this book rather than set out to write it. I'd encountered Cicero, in fact, very early on in my educational career in high school Latin. And when everyone else was kind of put off by the pompous, bombastic language, I was falling in love with someone who had that kind of command of language and whose ideas also I found quite compelling. But that interest sort of slumbered for quite a long time until I found myself in graduate school and encountering these other much, frankly, more compelling, sweeping histories of especially Western political thought that were built around the great division between, say, the ancients and the moderns, or the division between liberalism and republicanism. And I found myself repeatedly thinking, yeah, but that doesn't make sense in light of Cicero. I kept reading modern thinkers and seeing Cicero pop up all over the place. And I found myself at first just writing what I thought were just a couple of one-off articles about particular, especially early modern thinkers, Adam Smith, John Locke, and how it seemed to me quite clear that Cicero stood behind many of what we tend to view as their peculiarly modern liberal contributions. And before I knew it, I was halfway to a book, and I thought I may as well just power through. And I found as I was writing the book that I essentially did not know which chapter was coming after the one I was working on at the time until I found myself at the end. But once I stepped back from it, I was reasonably content that it made a coherent contribution about how we ought to think about the history of Western political thought and Cicero's place in it in particular. So that was, it was very much like the frog boiling sort of situation where I didn't realize the heat was turning up until it was already fairly high.
Good. Yeah. Well, are you the frog in that metaphor? Wait a second. So good. All right. So let's talk about some of, I think it's nice to just sort of start with some of those narratives that you talk about. You just mentioned, so the ancients versus the moderns of liberalism and republicanism, maybe just stick with those and just say a little bit about, what the kind of typical account of those divisions are and how it is that, Cicero doesn't quite fit into either side.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. So the ancients and moderns division, I mean, the recognition that there's some significant difference between ancient political thought and modern is at least as old as the sort of mid-Enlightenment, the liberty of the ancients and the liberty of the moderns. But when it comes to political theory training now, I would say people like Leo Strauss have been very powerful advocates for the idea that there's a fundamental break between classical political thought and modern political thought. And there are different ways of construing that break. But one of them is along the idea of political philosophy being primarily contemplative rather than active. So the idea that the ancients, especially the Greeks, thought what political philosophy was about was primarily pure perception or understanding. And to the extent that it was active only to protect the activity of philosophy. And that whereas modern political philosophers thought that to make use of Plato's metaphor of the cave, that the cave could be reformed and perhaps light brought into the cave, that political philosophy could be active, could remake the world. So that's one way of looking at the division. Another way of looking at the division is to say classical political philosophy imagined that politics was about the cultivation of virtue and that the good political regime was essentially, at least in part, a pedagogical regime, a regime that made its citizens better, made its citizens virtuous, and that the moderns abandoned this in favor of regimes that aimed considerably lower, that aimed at security or freedom or the protection of property or something like this. So there's that fairly sweeping account of the history of political thought in which people like Machiavelli or Hobbes mark the break from ancient thinking to modern thinking. And then, of course, there's the sort of parallel competing grand sweeping historical account that is often associated with the Cambridge School, with people like Quentin Skinner or J.G.A. Pocock, who posit a fundamental break between republicanism as a sort of contestatory, occasionally chaotic, considerably more virtue-oriented, somewhat more communally oriented vision of politics. On the one hand, that begins either in the ancient Greek polis or in Rome and continues up through the early modern period, only to find itself largely supplanted by a liberalism that centers instead of contestation and active commitment to the polity, a notion of rights built around the individual whose self-interest is supposed to be primary, where the good regime is a regime in which individual self-interest is given as much free rein as possible. And as I said, in both of those historical accounts, I think are still useful and still help organize and provide a kind of useful framework for understanding certain features of the history of Western political thought. But both of them are seriously complicated, at least, if not compromised, by the existence of Cicero. So I'm happy to get into that now, but did you want me to just elaborate on the epics themselves?
No, I mean, I think that's good. We can, we could sort of dig into to Cicero, I think, and then you could say how it is that his thought upends it. One other thing, though, I wanted to throw in terms of, sometimes the way these distinctions sort of break down, is the kind of, sometimes the ancients are often portrayed as viewing, politics is in some sense natural to human beings, whereas the moderns think of politics as in somehow artificial. There's this sort of artificial contractual relationship that's at the heart of, say, Hobbes and Locke's account. Hobbes spends a lot of time critiquing Aristotle and the naturalness of the polis, which I take it is connected to their accounts of the summum bonum and the human good. And how, at least for the ancients, want to think about the purpose of political community as related to, fostering full human life, whereas the moderns, the usual account goes is that politics is, about sort of lower goods or securing the material conditions in case for individuals to choose whatever kind of life they have. So I mean, is that another account that you think Cicero upends? Or
yes, I absolutely do. I think for me that sort of flows or is part and parcel with the division about the orientation of politics towards virtue or towards the improvement of the soul, that politics is natural precisely because it allows us to reach our highest. According to the ancients, according to this view of the ancients, politics is natural because it enables us to achieve what's highest in us. It's natural in that sense. And that therefore, yeah, it would often appear absurd to consider politics based on a contract, because you are not yet what you would become thanks to the political regime. You're not in a position in some ways to consent, because you'll be made better. You'd only be able to consent in retrospect in light of what the regime makes you. Whereas, yes, I think the moderns, very commonly Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, place the foundations of political order in a contract, which is to say it's not natural, and which is to say its aims, I gotta make sure that's silenced, are much lower, and do aim far less, at least in this account. The moderns aim far less at a transformation of the citizen. Rousseau might be an exception to this, I think, but Rousseau is often considered a bit more of an ancient among the moderns in that regard. But the liberals, at any rate, are the ones who are considered plausible candidates to be included in the modern liberal project, are often identified by virtue of the fact that their vision of politics is not one whose primary purpose is to make citizens better or to achieve their perfection, much less. And Cicero does upend that great division along with the others that I was enumerating, if we make it a different division. Yeah.
Good. Yeah. So let's talk about Cicero. So, well, I mean, I guess to ask you, I mean, how would you prefer to proceed? Would you rather sort of lay out what you take to be the essentials of Cicero's view, his view of republicanism and natural law, or would you prefer to sort of say sort of outright how he upends his?
I think probably doing the first bleeds pretty well into the second.
Okay. Okay.
I should start doing
okay,
that.
Good.
I stumble into the second.
Well, and that's good, because then we'll be able to, because I take it you sort of structured according to these two different pillars, which I found useful, which you trace then through his legacy, which is his Republican side and then his natural law side. Mm-hmm. I think you start with a natural law side in the book. So if you want to maybe sort of talk about Cicero's view of natural law, and we can chat about that for a bit.
Yeah, so Cicero is a very fascinatingly eclectic political thinker in a whole host of ways. And there are reasons that quite a lot of classicists, I think, often fail to appreciate the coherence of his thought and instead try to use him as essentially a mine for insights into lost Greek philosophers, especially Stoic philosophers, in part because Cicero appears to adopt something that looks an awful lot like Stoic natural law. But Cicero, as a philosopher at any rate, admits that when it comes to thinking specifically about virtue and duties, admits that he draws primarily from some Stoics, namely Panaetius, whose works are lost to us, and hence the classicist focus on trying to reconstruct Stoicism through Cicero. And this notion of natural law, I think, often is conflated by scholars with the natural law you're more likely to be familiar with if you've been trained in the history of political thought, the sort of Aristotle inflected version of natural law that you get out of someone like Aquinas, where natural law is thoroughly teleological, that what it is to talk about natural law is to recognize that all things have natural ends, that, you know, it is according to natural law, in other words, that the acorn becomes the oak tree, it's its natural fulfillment, and that one derives principles of morality and politics possibly from recognition of humans' natural ends. That's really, there's a slight element of that in Cicero's vision of natural law. But Cicero's vision of natural law actually reads much more to us, or should read much more to us, like law in the ordinary sense, but universal and cosmopolitan, which is to say, Cicero envisions the cosmos as being ruled by some sort of divine mind, some sort of supreme god. And under that supreme god, there are rational creatures. Well, Cicero is pretty agnostic about whether or not there are other divine rational creatures, but there are certainly rational creatures called human beings. And they are all naturally members of a universal cosmopolitan society under the direction of that supreme god or that supreme being. So there's a vision of this that you get at the end of De Republica or Cicero's On the Republic, but it's pointed to elsewhere in Cicero's works, including in On Duties and On the Ends of Good and Evil, that this is Cicero's vision of the human condition, is that we are rational creatures who are natural compatriots in a certain sense, that there is some universal political community. And by virtue of our citizenship in that universal political community, there are certain things which are commanded of us and certain things which are forbidden to us. We recognition of our common citizenship with others requires that we not exploit others for our own gain, requires that we recognize principles of reciprocity when dealing with others, requires that we only harm others in order to prevent harm to ourselves or others, or as a way of sort of preventing harm in the more macro sense of punishing wrongdoers as a way of warning others not to commit harm. We have true, if relatively thin, positive obligations to others. So Cicero says where your own interests would not be seriously compromised, you owe others what they need. And so he gives a series of examples where it's clear you would lose nothing from helping another. If someone needs to share your fire or needs a drink of water, if someone, perhaps more significantly, requires knowledge or your wisdom, you have an obligation to share it, because the sharing of it diminishes you in no way. And then this vision of universal communal fellowship gets complicated by the fact that Cicero believes that the practical way of working out that fellowship is in discrete political communities, in states, which then produce for themselves a much thicker set of mutual obligations and duties that flow downstream from the original ones and are not meant to conflict with the original ones. And this overall is a vision of natural law that says, that I would describe as universalist. So Cicero at one point says, it's really important that there be not one law here and another law in Athens, one thing right here and another thing right there, or another thing right, or something right now and a different thing right then. That the principles of the fundamental principles of moral behavior and through moral behavior, political behavior, are universally binding on everyone. And therefore also not particularly attentive to distinctions of rank, including distinctions of rank of virtue. So this is another way in which Cicero's vision of natural law differentiates itself from Aristotle. And I know that it's somewhat controversial to say Aristotle has natural law. It may just be that he inspires it when it comes to people like Aquinas. But where Cicero's vision of moral obligation seriously differs from someone like Aristotle is that while Cicero acknowledges that there are people who are by nature better and worse, that is to say, there are people who are wiser than others, who are more advanced in virtue than others, who have higher claims to rule or to govern than others do, the egalitarian nature of obligations that derive from natural law mean that there is no such thing as natural rulers and natural ruled, or much less natural masters and natural slaves, that there is not one rule for thee and another for me, or something right for you and not right for me based on our nature. It can be based on our peculiar circumstances. That is to say, the same action might cause greater harm here than there, or the same action might do greater good here than there. But the basic logic of how you are bound in obligation to your fellow human beings applies everywhere to everyone, regardless of whether or not they've consented, which is what then creates an interesting dynamic with the other major pillar of Cicero's thought.
That's good. That's very helpful. I mean, so, but does that mean that Cicero is is a theorist of human equality then before? Mm-hmm. Maybe you could say a little bit about that, because that would be quite surprising if he, the final point that you landed on, I think, is the key one, which is about what natural law has to say about, say, the aristocratic character of ancient thought, in a way Aristotle justifies a kind of rule that's not based on consent, rule that's in accordance with nature. So Cicero rejects that, and on what basis does he do so?
Sure. So yes, Cicero is a kind of egalitarian, and that's there are in fact scholars, Thomas Carlyle, who wrote, I think, around the turn of the century, was a scholar who argued that the birth of truly egalitarian political theory is Cicero. He says that Cicero emerges out and against Aristotle as championing human equality. And I think that's a little too strong and may, at least from our egalitarian sensibilities, give Cicero a little too much credit. But there is the valences of his natural law are egalitarian in the broad sense of being binding on everyone and not being moved by different by claims to differing levels of virtue or wisdom and the like. And so the way this works itself out in Cicero's political and social thought is not that Cicero is an advocate for purely egalitarian politics. In fact, he's, when it comes to the political divisions of his day, it would be fairer, though still simplistic, to find Cicero a member of the aristocratic party, that in the divisions of the late Roman Republic, Cicero sides with the aristocratic Senate against populists like Julius Caesar. He looks back to the agrarian reforms of the Gracchi as largely ill-considered and potentially unjust. Cicero thinks that as a matter of prudence and as a lower order matter of right, the kind of right of giving to each their due, it would be better for political communities to trust the workings of government to wise and virtuous statesmen, to public-spirited and virtuous men. That said, his natural law precludes him from saying that those men are entitled to rule by virtue of those qualities. So in other words, this is where consent starts to come into Cicero's political theory. If precisely because each human being has equal moral claims on the other, and precisely because Cicero claims that the differences between human beings are never so great as the kind of difference Aristotle ascribes to the difference between a master and a slave, where Aristotle says the slave is essentially a sentient instrument, that they may be able to recognize reason but not actually make use of it, that they're incapable of self-governance. Cicero doesn't see nearly so stark a distinction between human beings, and thinks, partly because of that and partly because of the fact that each human being essentially is of equal moral worth, that we're all citizens of equal standing in that great cosmopolis, that to be ruled justly requires your consent. That Cicero now doesn't have a completely fleshed out vision of how that consent is manifested. But he seems to think that the Roman Republic, when it functioned well, did a good job of, on the one hand, recognizing that all citizens have a right to a say in who their governors are, but was quite happy to note that they tended not to insist on making use of their right to govern themselves on a daily basis. So at one point, he almost likens it to joint ownership of sort of a commercial enterprise, and says, you know, we're all equal owners of the commercial enterprise, but we're not all going to be as good at the day-to-day running of it. And so we're wise, we're well advised to pick the best people to do the running of it. But because it's ours, if we choose not to pick those best people, they have no right to seize it from us. They have no right to impose their superior wisdom on us. And that's one of the many, I think, interesting tensions that then that develops out of Cicero's, on the one hand, loosely egalitarian moral vision, on the one hand, and his recognition that there are hierarchies of virtue and wisdom on the other. I should say one other thing, which is Cicero never draws what for us would be the logical conclusion that these principles of natural law require the abolition of slavery or the enfranchisement of women or anything along those lines. He does go considerably further than really any Romans except for later Stoic thinkers in saying that the obligations of justice apply to slaves as much as they do to everyone else. He simply then does not draw the necessary logical step of saying, well, if that's true, then there really shouldn't be slaves. But even in that for us rather lukewarm, milquetoasty sort of treatment of slavery, he seems to plant seeds of it would be difficult to avoid saying abolitionist logic of saying that there is no slave. Cicero never acknowledges slavery as natural. He just doesn't seem particularly interested in abolishing, practically speaking, its unnatural manifestations.
Okay, got it. Yeah, and I mean this is quite interesting because I often associate. I mean this discussion will shade into the Republican side of Cicero. You know, I often associate. I don't know much about Cicero, but I would associate him with a sort of mixed regime tradition, right? Where you have Aristotle and Polybius and so forth, who, you know, yes. Who argue that there, you know, that there's these various kinds of features of a regime that are a monarchical feature, a aristocratic feature, and a democratic feature. The claims to justice of each of them are rooted in some sense in nature, right? The aristocratic on the claim to human excellence, on the democratic on the claim to human equality. So what you're saying though is that it sounds like Cicero is actually better understood not as a part of that mixed regime tradition because he doesn't recognize the sort of natural claim to justice of the aristocrats. Like, so he doesn't think the Roman Senate has, like, you know, the claims to birth on the part of the Senate or whatever are only legitimate insofar as the people approve of that.
Yes. So, and this is, it's quite complex, I think, in Cicero's case, because legitimate, I think, would be the right word when speaking about the claims of the Senate. They would only be legitimate in light of the consent of the people. And yet there are what I guess you would call lower order claims of justice for them insofar as they are wise and public spirited to govern predominantly in the regime. In other words, Cicero, it's again, I think in some ways it is helpful to think about it in terms of this joint commercial enterprise vision, which is if you are the owner of the commercial enterprise and you happen to have good stewards at the helm, those stewards have a certain lower level claim to justice to be allowed to continue in their trust, in their role. That is to say, if you fired them, they would be within their rights to say that that was unfair. I was doing a good job. I was serving you well. You've behaved, you might say this, the people have would behave unjustly, not entrusting most of the significant decision-making to public-spirited members who are primarily drawn from this aristocratic class. That said, should the people choose to do something so imprudent as to deprive those people of their authority, those people have no external claim rooted in the nature of things to persist in their authority. And that's where it does seem that the consent trumps those lower order claims to superior, you might say, competence or practical wisdom that the Senate would have. And so yes and no to the claims of justice, I suppose, of the aristocrats. Cicero is, I think, helpfully viewed as a member of that mixed regime tradition, insofar as he's quite clear that he thinks the mixed regime is the best regime. He doesn't even qualify it in the way that Aristotle sometimes does in, say, the best practical regime. Cicero doesn't conceive of a best regime that is not practical. And when Cicero looks at the Roman constitution, I actually think this Leo Strauss is the person who said this, he looks at it almost as Burke looks at the English constitution, the happy, that is to say, fortunate product of a historical, of an unguided historical process that fortunately for its inhabitants has evolved and developed to a state of near perfection, of combining the justice claims of egalitarian consent in Cicero's vision, along with the prudential considerations that would lead you to, you might almost say, outsource some of your egalitarian rights to people who can manage things better for you. And the further prudential claim, and it is a purely prudential claim, for monarchy, which is to say you need someone who can make quick decisions. You need, in a hostile world, you need, especially when it comes to issues of force, an office that facilitates decisive action and unitary command. And Cicero finds that in the office of the consulship and in extremis in the dictatorship. But there is absolutely no claim to justice on behalf of that monarch. In fact, Cicero has his character Scipio say in De Republica, from the perspective of prudence, a monarchy might be the best because a wise monarch will make all the right decisions and doesn't have to deal with division and conflict and the various other inconveniences of republican government. But a people who live under a monarch lack freedom and consent. And that for him is simply disqualifying for monarchy simply. There is no justness claim that the monarch has over and against a people. And that goes the same for Rome's monarch substitutes, the consuls and the dictators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder if the distinction sometimes drawn between legitimacy and justice is helpful here, because it's, yes, you know, it almost seems like Cicero is, you know, you might say, a founder of the popular sovereignty tradition in the sense, yeah, that we think about in the modern tradition, where you have, instead of focusing on justice, what you do is you justice is a feature of the sort of natural characteristics of a regime. Focus instead on the choice or agency of the fundamental authorizing agent in a regime, right? And so, yeah, that's the agent that confers legitimacy on the use of coercion or political power. And over and against, I mean, you know, you can still make claims about, you know, something can, you know, a people can authorize some legitimate action that's nonetheless unjust, right? I mean, so there can be a kind of a legitimate process that's carried out in terms of a sovereign's action that, you know, throws people in Guantanamo Bay or something like that we might say also is in some sense unjust. So, I mean, I don't know if that's useful. I mean, and this gets to your, if you want to say some points about, you know, the tension that I think emerges in Cicero's thought here.
Yeah. So no, this is very good. And I do take Cicero as being a sort of founding contributor to the notion of popular sovereignty precisely along these lines. There is no term for sovereignty that he has access to. So it's hard to say he is the founder of the notion of popular sovereignty precisely, but the concept seems to live in his thought, and the concept being that all political authority flows from the people ultimately. There is no other source of legitimacy for political decision-making than the people who make up the political community. And to the extent that that's just what the notion of popular sovereignty is, Cicero is a theorist of popular sovereignty and the earliest one I certainly could identify. But you're right that sits, it establishes at least something of a, you can either describe it as a disjunction between legitimacy or justice, or if you think of legitimacy as a sort of like higher order justice claim, you get a sort of division of justice on different levels. And so you might think, I don't know, a lot of people might have said, for instance, that the British public was in some ways unjust in voting Winston Churchill out just at the moment that he had proven himself to have been the worthy steward of their country during World War II. But no one would say Churchill in turn would have been just for retaining power and refusing to give up the premiership, his prime ministerial post. That I think captures that insight, which is the continuing democratic insight that has found itself maybe a little bit challenged in recent years, but the vision that even if you voted for the losing candidate and thought that person deserved on some sense of justice to either be elected or to be reelected, that should they not receive the mandate of the rest of the people, it would not be just for that person to continue to hold office. That kind of division lives within Cicero's political thought. And depending on the circumstance in which he's writing, it can be easy to miss it or make him seem inconsistent, because when Cicero is writing, when Cicero is writing with, writing philosophically, writing his great political philosophic works, the emphasis is much more clearly on the high order principle of popular sovereignty. And yet when Cicero is dealing with the nitty-gritty workings of politics, because he is also a very active statesman in an incredibly chaotic period of the Roman state, he's often insisting that particular decisions being made by the people are unjust on that sort of lower order level, that for the, you know, the great popular support enjoyed by Julius Caesar, for instance, and later the faction that supports Mark Antony are making the wrong decisions, are things he also will stridently denounce as both imprudent, but also unjust in some sense. And so he's trying to, I think he believes there is an ultimate coherence, and there's a coherence that we can recognize in this thought, I think. But it does make for, it produces tensions. There's no way of denying that those commitments, the commitment to popular sovereignty on the one hand, and to other notions of just deserts produce, following one but not the other produces different outcomes. And Cicero's solution to the problem, I think, is to hierarchically rank these principles of justice such that one trumps the other.
That's good. Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to see the sort of tensions between liberalism and democracy. one might say, sort of already here at work. So maybe just briefly, I mean, we've been sort of talking about Cicero's thought, but just to circle back to the main claim, if you want to sort of conclude talking about Cicero in terms of, okay, so how is it that this, you know, what you've just been describing can kind of upend some of these categorizations in history, political thought?
So you have in Cicero's thought then this on the one hand universalist commitment to natural law, and on the other hand this belief in popular sovereignty that I think is the dynamic tension that produces most of his, the interesting features of his political thought. And this makes Cicero problematic for pretty much any of those divisions that we were talking about a little while ago. So for instance, if you're the sort of person who thinks that the distinction between ancient and modern thought is that the ancients are consider political philosophy to be primarily contemplative, and the moderns are the ones who think that political philosophy should be, you might say, architectonic or active. Cicero is an ancient who has modern sensibilities. Cicero's vision of political philosophy is that it's useful for helping us redesign our political institutions. That is to say, politics comes first for Cicero. Action, the active life, is higher than the contemplative life for Cicero. He's quite explicit about this at a number of points. And in case anyone is still in doubt, as some scholars are, that that's the case, one need only look at his life. That is to say, when Cicero philosophizes is almost exclusively the times when he's forced out of politics, because Cicero believes that human beings are active creatures, that that therefore action, that contemplation is for the sake of action, and therefore political philosophy is a very high human endeavor, but it's a high human endeavor because it should inform politics. That is, we should do politics differently in light of the insights and discoveries of political philosophy, which makes him seem like a modern amongst the ancients. If, on the other hand, the vision, you take the fundamental distinction between the ancients and the moderns to be either the ancient view of the naturalness of politics versus the modern view of it being artificial and created by consent, or the ancient view that politics is primarily pedagogical and is teleological, good politics makes citizens better people, helps them advance in virtue, helps them reach their fulfillment, whereas the moderns are not trying to reform people so much as get them security and prosperity or something like that. Cicero again seems like a modern amongst the ancients. His vision of political society, first, he has a state of nature theory. I didn't mention this earlier, but Cicero acknowledges that there was a time before political societies when human beings simply did not live together in large groups, claims that the origin of political societies depended then on consent, and the legitimacy of political societies always depends on consent. And that his vision of politics is extremely thin. In fact, I have looked in vain for evidence that Cicero believes that one of the primary functions of a good political regime is to educate its citizens, in large part because that vision of a political society based on consent makes the idea of a pedagogical regime on the order of, say, Plato's Republic a little bit silly, because we are co-owners of our political society. And so it would seem a little bit strange for our property to rule over and remake us. That Cicero's vision of what politics is for sounds quite a lot more modern in that sense. He says political societies probably initially came into being in order to protect property, and that when establishing universal principles of right about what political regimes should do, they're to secure us against injustice, which is to say against wrongful harm. Cicero's quite clear that what injustice is wrongful harm. They're to protect our property, to protect our lives, and to enable us to live freely, to choose our own path in life. All of this makes him sound incredibly modern, it seems to me. And on the other hand, to then turn to the liberal Republican division, Cicero is undeniably a Republican. He dies for his Republican commitments. There's one thing one can't doubt about Cicero. It's that he believes in the legitimacy of Republican institutions. He is a committed believer in, therefore, popular sovereignty. But Cicero's vision of what a Republic is for is not nearly so chaotic and contestatory as some other members of this so-called Republican tradition, most notably Machiavelli, would have it. Cicero's vision of a healthy Republic is a cooperative, harmonious one. And Cicero acknowledges that there will be political disputes and values a healthy republic in part for managing those, but a well-functioning republic is one in which there is a recognition of the principles of justice by the members, and therefore a state of more cooperation than of contestation. And it's a state, moreover, characterized by a liberty that Cicero describes as not having a master, which sounds quite Republican, according to the great division between Republicans and liberals. But then he goes on to say, what it means to not have a master is to live your life as you see fit. Then there's a decent chunk of his great work, De Officiis on Duties, that that basically points to the absolute essential requirement that human beings plan out, each individual human being plans out a life for himself. And that sounds awfully liberal. Cicero says good political communities protect private property. They enable their citizens to manage their own private lives as they see fit. And the great sweeping distinction between liberalism and republicanism is supposed to break down right along these lines, is to say liberals want to protect private property and want to protect a private sphere in which citizens can pursue their own private self-interest, whereas republicans look for patriotic, self-sacrificial virtue in participating in the contestatory politics of a sort of Machiavellian, Florentine-ish kind of republic. And it just is not the case for Cicero. Cicero believes that republican institutions achieve what we would now call liberal freedom, that those things, far from being in opposition to one another, are mutually dependent. And so on both of these counts, when you start or on all of these counts, because I'm starting to lose count of the different ways in which these sweeping histories try to categorize thinkers, Cicero is problematic for all of them. He's an ancient among the moderns. He's a liberal amongst the republicans. He's a defender of the active political life amongst the contemplative philosophers. And that not only makes him fascinating for me in his own right, but does, I think, profoundly complicate some of these histories, which I'm happy to then turn to talk about if you'd like.
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, just one last question on this. I mean, I've never particularly been convinced by the liberal Republican divide. Certainly that one, even in the American political thought context, is not convincing at all. But on the ancient versus modern divide, so I guess my question for you then at the end of the day is, how do you think about this divide then? Is your view then that, you know, we shouldn't use an ancient versus modern divide, or that Cicero just is a modern, like, and we should classify him as such, or that he's like a transitionary figure? Like, if you're rewriting the history of political thought, I guess, I mean, you do this in part in the book. You know, you're like, look, we need to reintroduce Cicero and political theories, syllabuses. And I'm convinced by that. So, but how do you present him then in that context in the history?
I have always felt that If one were a little bit more modest in describing the ancient modern divide as saying there's a division between Greek political philosophy and most of what comes after, I think Cicero would not complicate it. But most of the people who argue for the ancient modern divide include the Romans, like Cicero, in the ancient side of the division. And so I think part of the problem is that people, that the Romans in general, and Cicero in particular, is too often made out to be a sort of faithful student of the Greeks, and he gives reasons for that. Cicero is profoundly influenced by Aristotle, but especially by Plato, as well as by various Stoic thinkers and Epicurean thinkers for that matter. But he is not, I would describe him more as something like a transitional figure. I wouldn't say he is simply a modern. He has quite a lot of ancient sensibilities, even though he doesn't think, for instance, that politics is primarily about the cultivation of virtue. Virtue is a central feature to his moral and political thought. He is pragmatically or aristocratic in a way that most moderns are not. He is, therefore, I take him to be, what I argue in the book that he is the figure amongst the ancients who provides by far the most inspiration for the early moderns, at any rate, the liberal republicans who will feature in the later book. He is, I think, he is transitional, I would say, is probably the best term to use for him. I'm not sure I use that term in the book, but I think it would be fair to describe him that way, as someone who points toward, without fully fleshing out, what will later become the sort of modern or early modern liberal republican dispensation.
Yeah, that's good. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about that history. I don't think we have time to go through all of it, sure. But I wanted to certainly hit on Machiavelli and Locke, who are kind of two of the important figures in your history. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the, your chapter right after Cicero is about Machiavelli as part of Cicero's legacy. And this is the sort of critical moment of the Ciceronian legacy, is you portray Machiavelli as one of the great critics of Cicero's thinking. And I mean, one of the useful things about this chapter is it really, you know, it takes a stand in, you know, Machiavelli scholarship, and helps, I think your argument is, but in part by appreciating Cicero's sort of proto-modernism, we can kind of better situate where Machiavelli himself stands, actually, in the history of political thought. So maybe you could say a little bit about, I mean, how Machiavelli critiqued Cicero, and then how you sort of situate him in the story.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Machiavelli chapter is the first example in the making my case that I had no idea what chapter was coming after writing the previous chapter. I found, after I had written the chapter on Cicero, when I was writing this as a dissertation, that I showed it to some of my advisors, and one of them said, "Oh, so Cicero basically sounds like Machiavelli to me." And I nearly hit the roof, because I thought it was quite clear from how I was describing Cicero, but it was precisely the opposite of Machiavelli. And so I found myself having to write this chapter as a way of just disproving that misreading of myself that I'd somehow cultivated. Machiavelli does feature central in all of those great divisions of the ancients and moderns, or liberals and republicans. Machiavelli is a central feature in all of figure in all of those, either as the great breaker from the ancients to the moderns, or as the culmination of the republican tradition. And I have to say, I got to Machiavelli working both backwards and forwards. Working forwards from Cicero, I did think Machiavelli is misunderstood if you take him to be a culmination of a tradition inaugurated by Cicero, unless by culmination you mean repudiation. But I also worked backwards from him and thought there are a lot of profound insights in Machiavelli's political philosophy, some of which clearly are, we would say, characteristically modern, especially visions of conquering fortune, for instance, a rethinking of the nature of virtue. But when I think about what Machiavellian politics looks like, the kind of politics that Machiavelli seems to endorse, including Republican politics that he seems to endorse in, say, the Discourses on Livy, I thought that doesn't look terribly like how we tend to envision modern liberalism, for instance. That a Lockean state, for instance, doesn't share terribly much with Machiavelli's vision of Rome, for instance, it seems to me. And so by working both backwards and forwards, I thought it was necessary for me to give an account of how Machiavelli related to Cicero, which is primarily as a critic, it seems to me. And then looking forward from Machiavelli, it seems to me that we often make the mistake of thinking that the later chronological figure must sort of have won out over the earlier one when it comes to influencing subsequent thought. And it seems to me that's simply not the case, at least when it comes to early modern thinkers. So to then get into the content there a little bit, which I've been dancing around, Machiavelli fundamentally rejects at least one of the pillars of the Ciceronian project, the natural law position. That I cannot imagine anyone seriously arguing that Machiavelli is a natural law theorist in any recognizable sense. And I think, given that for Cicero, the popular sovereignty, the other pillar, the popular sovereignty pillar, I think can best be made sense of as being somewhat dependent on and downstream from the natural law position. In other words, the people are rightful owners of their political community precisely because they are by natural law equal and free. Machiavelli's repudiation of pillar number one ends up entailing a repudiation of pillar number two. And what you get is a Republican vision of politics, to be sure, a vision that says republics are better than other forms of political organization, but not because, or not primarily because, they're more likely to achieve some universal standard of justice, not because they protect what we would now call the rights of citizens to life or liberty or property, but because they're more vigorous, but because they are better suited for war and conquest, because they better give useful channels for ambition in those who are animated by the desire for power and glory. And that therefore Machiavelli's vision of Republican politics is much more contestatory, is considerably less tethered to notions of justice, is considerably more chaotic, is considerably more bellicose than the Ciceronian version. And that, and this then starts to move towards the later chapters of the book, that I think quite a lot of the early modern liberals preferred the Ciceronian version, preferred the principles underlying the Cicero's thought, and preferred what politics would look like, according to Cicero, than the vision offered by Machiavelli.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, right, in part, we could have a lengthy discussion, I think, about Machiavelli here, but maybe best to avoid it. But what occurs to me off the top of my head is, I mean, I guess where you begin in the Machiavelli chapter, which is to point out that Machiavelli would situate Cicero as part of that, you know, this sort of castles in the air tradition from chapter 15 of The Prince, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, principles are all well and good and everything, but what we need to actually pay attention to is what the actual character of political life is, right? And that the character of political life is quite vigorous and bellicose and so forth and so on. And so actually, in order to bring any kind of order and stability and to meet people's needs requires us to sort of forget about all those castles in the air.
Yeah, I think that is, I think, probably the core of the Machiavellian challenge, not merely to Cicero, but also to say Plato, is precisely that. And I think one could very fairly and reasonably say also that Machiavelli's depiction of Roman politics is a more accurate and realistic depiction than that offered by Cicero himself as he lived through Rome. I think that's, one would have to concede that. I try to mostly keep my own views of the dispute in its own right out of the book. It is mostly a history of ideas, but I think to defend Cicero on this count though a little bit, because I think defending Cicero on this count is necessary for making the case that later thinkers might prefer him to Machiavelli. Machiavelli's view of politics has the appeal of we might call sort of like cynical realism, that there is I think there's always an intuitive plausibility to the person who says, you know, you're not being realistic, you don't understand how truly evil human beings are, how truly unreliable, base, selfish, and so on they are. And that the consequences Machiavelli draws from that then are, as you were sort of pointing to, you yourself can't be particularly virtuous then in the ordinary sense. If you're going to get anything done amongst human beings, that resting your regime on principles of justice, for instance, is just a kind of foolishness. I'm not sure though that Cicero doesn't have a pretty good case to make when he says, actually, most of the time, maybe all of the time if you look at it with a sufficient degree of abstraction, the morally upright and the useful things are aligned. So Cicero's argument, for instance, about why the Roman Republic is such a, is at least the Roman Constitution is the ideal practical regime, is it's very difficult to tease out when Cicero is talking about the prudential practical advantages of that regime, the ways in which it blends the various the claims to justice versus the claims of prudence on the, you know, what we were talking about earlier with consent of the people in the aristocratic Senate on the one hand, and the fact that its justness makes it stable and strong. So Cicero seems to think that it is precisely because the Roman regime better instantiates justice, that it on the one hand had for so long avoided internal dissolution, and of course Cicero dies just as this eventually happens, but that it had avoided internal dissolution for so long that it was also resilient in the face of external threats is because people's claims to justice were largely met and therefore were not only satisfied but passionately devoted to the regime. So one of Cicero's maybe most influential work is on duties, where the fundamental thesis is that the honorable, the morally upright on the one hand, and the useful are identical. And Machiavelli is alluring in denying that link. But I tend to think that in some ways, the basic principle of liberal consent tends to side with Cicero on this and to say, what makes liberal regimes stable is at least in part their justice, that they have, that they acknowledge their reliance on consent and reflect in some ways the natural claims to liberty and equality of their citizens. And so that in a nutshell, I think there's way more that one could say about this, especially about the nature of being and seeming, which is a key Machiavellian objection to classical thought. But at its core, I do think that the disagreement between Machiavelli and Cicero is precisely about whether or not justice is necessary for political stability in general. And I think many later thinkers end up siding with Cicero on this.
Yeah, that seems right. I mean, I think to see Machiavelli as the founder of modernity, I think then it doesn't equip us to understand some of the disagreements about that emerge about Machiavelli. For example, in Mandeville, who's clearly Machiavellian, and the sort of outrages that emerge about commercial society and virtue that come out in the 18th century, the disagreements between, you could say, a kind of Ciceronian view and a Machiavellian view. So, I mean, I find your narrative very persuasive in this way, to see it, you know, sort of modernity as a kind of conflict between Ciceronian and Machiavellian alternatives. And you have a chapter on, which I don't want to talk about, but just to mention and recommend it, but the sort of chapter about sort of branching traditions from Cicero, Grotius, and Pufendorf, and some of the English Republican thinkers. I wanted to go, though, to Locke, who represents, in your view, the kind of maybe culmination, I don't know if that's the right word, but certainly, I mean, your Cicero certainly reminded me of Locke, and then I think that was confirmed when I got to the Locke chapter. And it seems to me you think of Locke as a sort of the figure who most or best represents this sort of Ciceronian thought in the modern era, and one who kind of best resolves some of the tensions that still reside in Cicero. So you could say, talk through your accounts of Locke. I think it might be helpful to say a little bit about the Locke scholarship. Again, there's the same sort of, you know, another one of these hinge figures who, is Locke a natural law thinker or not, right? Does he belong to an earlier era, or is he distinctively modern? Is he more of a Hobbesian, or is he more of, you know? So in any case, we could say a little bit about that and how like viewing him as a Ciceronian is useful.
Yeah, sure. And I do take Locke I take to be the culmination, or maybe I would like to view him as the test case for this thesis about Cicero's late legacy, is that if you buy the argument in the Locke chapter, I would be content if you did not buy the rest of the book. I mean, please, you know, give me your money, buy the rest of the book. But if you did not buy the argument of the rest of the book, I could live with that. And I do think this is probably where the argument of the book is most radically challenging to standard scholarship, I think, because there's very little on the link between Cicero and Locke at all in the scholarship, almost none. And yet one of the things I'm arguing is that Locke is fundamentally influenced by Cicero, that Cicero may be the key influence for Locke. And yes, yeah, so Locke is this, as you note, is this very contested figure in scholarship. Is he the first liberal, for instance, or is he a liberal in a line that points back to Hobbes, whom he claims never to have read, but calls him the justly decried monster of Malmesbury? So how could he possibly know that Hobbes was justly decried if he had not read him? Is he a natural law thinker, or is the natural law, for instance, essentially a cover for smuggling in something like a justified self-interest or a radical notion of self-ownership? Or is Locke, for instance, is Locke a true believing if heterodox Christian, or is he part of this stealth war against Christianity that's being waged in early modernity? There are all sorts of ways in which Locke is fought over, and I don't claim to decisively settle most of them, but I do think we gain insights on several of those debates by situating Locke in relationship to Cicero. And so, the general neglect of the influence of Cicero in early modernity is one of the things that my book seeks to sort of rectify, that just in the period where we're often sort of expecting to see modern thinkers decisively reject classical thought, it turns out this is the height of Cicero's posthumous influence, or there's a good case to be made that it is, that his books are wildly outselling virtually all other classical authors, including often Plato and Aristotle put together, other early moderns who I don't talk about in the book, ranging from Adam Smith and Hume to Kant, all acknowledge debts to him. But when it comes to Locke in particular, there is overwhelming evidence, it seems to me, that Locke is deeply influenced by Cicero. So there's contextual evidence that has to do with the curriculum, that both Locke himself experiences as a student and then goes on to teach when he works as a collegiate instructor. There is evidence from Locke's own library, which is that Cicero is outpaced only by Locke himself amongst authors whose works are found in Locke's library. Cicero's De Officiis, there are only more copies of the Bible than there are of De Officiis in Locke's library. Cicero makes the epigraph to both the Second Treatise on Government, as well as, I'm having a mental lapse for the moment, his work on epistemology.
The essay concerning human understanding. Essay, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The epigraph to the essay, both are Cicero quotes. Locke tells his reader in his work on education that after the Bible, he's not sure a child needs to read anything other than Cicero's De Officiis in order to be properly morally educated. Then he goes on to modify that by saying, well, also he could read Grotius and Pufendorf, who I've just spent the previous chapter trying to demonstrate, are also Ciceronians. The evidence, therefore, seems, the circumstantial evidence of Locke being deeply engaged with Cicero seems to be, to me, to be overwhelming. But the real proof is in the pudding, which is, yet does his thought show signs of being influenced by Cicero? And I think it does, some in ways that would be obvious from what we've just discussed. So Locke is, whether or not he's a natural law theorist, and I'll come back to that in a second, Locke definitely thinks that politics is not natural. He believes, he posits, at least as theoretically useful, a state of nature theory, bases government in consent. His vision of the good form of government rests on that consent permanently, but also has a vision that it's best to consent to pick people to do your governing for you, by and large. He's not a direct democrat or anything of the sort. The real question, though, I think, is to what extent is Cicero's or is Locke's natural law genuine? I think this is a major dispute in the scholarship, because it's very difficult to make sense of Locke's natural law theory, mostly because he never spells it out anywhere, right? At least in his published works. Locke begins the Second Treatise on Government by talking about what natural law permits and does not permit, but never really explains it besides saying natural law is what reason would tell you. And one of the things that I do in this chapter is I look to the one place we do have Locke trying to work out his natural law, which is an unpublished work that are questions or a series of almost scholastically formatted discussions of natural law, which Locke himself never published, though a number of his friends saw it and seemed quite confused as to why he had not. And I argue that the logic of Locke's natural law there, while still having certain significant theoretical tensions, basically looks like Cicero's natural law. That is to say, it's not the Thomistic natural law of where the focus and priority is on natural ends of human beings, and that therefore politics is then becomes natural and blessed by natural law as the vehicle by which we achieve some of our natural ends. Instead, the natural law is, at least there, again, the law in a much more ordinary sense of commanding and prohibiting certain actions and behaviors and backing them up by threats of rewards and punishment, a law whose sanction ultimately rests in divine authority, and that law basically requires us to acknowledge duties of reciprocity to others, obligations not to harm others. Locke manages to derive, which Cicero never quite managed to do, sanction for private property from this natural law. And I think that's one of Locke's great contributions and innovations on Cicero's thought, is that Cicero desperately wanted to justify private property as a central feature of the good regime, that it would be protected, but could not locate it according to natural law. And Locke comes up with an account that does this. And so I take Locke's general silence in his published works on natural law to be at least potentially explainable by the things he says elsewhere, directing his readers to read Cicero and Cicero's modern expositors of natural law, namely Grotius and Pufendorf. And I take Locke to be essentially saying, once you recognize the truth of this natural law, certain political consequences follow. And that's essentially what I take the Second Treatise on Government to essentially be doing. And if you buy this argument, it on the one hand explains why my Cicero sounds so Lockean, is because in some ways I say Locke is a Ciceronian. But it also, I do think, I would never claim proves, but I think lends weight to the notion that Locke was sincere in his natural law thinkings, and that his reticence to spell out the natural law was based in part on a confidence that intellectual work had largely been done. That in Thoughts on Education, for instance, he basically says, read Cicero, and then read Locke's near and pseudo contemporaries who are expositors of the Ciceronian natural law. I've rambled a little bit
there. No, that's good. I mean, that's all helpful. I mean, I wanted to hone in on two things that we sort of characterize as distinctively Lockean: private property and limited government, and just sort of get your take on it. Because when thinking about private property and thinking about limited government, Cicero is not the first person that comes to mind in terms of a sort of core influence. So maybe you could kind of disabuse me on it. So private property, I mean, as I understood your discussion of Cicero on private property, I was surprised to learn that he's sort of a defender of private property, which is great. But it strikes me from it seems like his account has to do with private property is that there's a political justification, as it were, right? That private property is good insofar as it, you know, facilitates a stable polity or whatever. Whereas Locke's view of private property, you know, justification of private property is fundamentally pre-political, yes, right? It's fundamentally different. So how do you square those? Maybe that's just, yeah. I mean, I said, you said a moment ago, this is Locke's maybe innovation. So maybe you could just say a little bit. I mean, do you see any influence there, or is this just distinct between the two thinkers?
No, I there is a distinction, and I do take Locke to be innovating in a massive way on Cicero here. But I do take it to be an innovation in line with the general thrust of Cicero's thought. It does seem to me that Cicero is deeply invested, possibly in part for sort of lower personal reasons, as being a member of the landed aristocracy himself, more or less, that he wants to justify private property and wants to ground it as thickly as he can. He never manages to completely ground it in nature, but he's not as far from Locke on this as he might seem. So on the one hand, Cicero does have a pre-political notion of property that maps at least partially well onto to Locke. So like Locke, Cicero imagines that at first the world was one giant commons. The world belonged to mankind in common. And Locke is the one who manages to figure a theoretical way from that to private property that has to do with self-ownership, or at least self-usufruct, we might say, depending on whether God really owns us and mixing our labor with the land, and therefore mixing what's truly ours with the commons, and therefore bringing things out of the commons. Cicero doesn't quite have that notion, I think in part because he lacks a thick notion of self-ownership that doesn't allow him to draw the Lockean conclusions. But Cicero does argue that property predates political society. He argues, in fact, that probably as a historical matter, the first political societies were founded in the effort to protect private property, that men had huts or farms or whatever and realized they needed to band together in order to protect them from both wild animals and marauding bands of other human beings. But Cicero can't quite then say that makes private property natural. Instead, he ends up drawing on a Stoic analogy and saying the relationship between property and private ownership is like your seat in a theater, which is the seat isn't really yours, but if you happen to find yourself sitting in it in a way that you didn't kick someone else out of the seat, it would be wrong for someone else to kick you out of yours. And that bleeds into Cicero's vision of how property works in a healthy functioning political society, which is that for Cicero, having clear distinctions between mine and thine prevents rather than causes strife. So in other words, there are a number of thinkers, you know, possibly going back as far as Plato, heading forward as far as Marx, who think, no, the private property is the source of strife. You know, things being yours but not mine, or mine but not yours, is why we fight over things. And Cicero seems to think that, in fact, in the same way that having assigned seats in the theater would prevent us from beating each other up over seats that are otherwise held in common by all of us, or by neglecting, or in turn, and this is a good Aristotelian insight as well, or by neglecting, you know, the care for your particular seat in the theater, having assigned seats, respecting how Cicero has to admit by chance the distribution of property has fallen, conduces to political harmony. And I think this is, for one thing, probably one of the least persuasive lines of argument in Cicero's political thought, and one of the ways in which I think Cicero would have preferred to ground it. The justification for property in natural law shines forth most clearly, and is one of the reasons why I do take Locke to be contributing something that Cicero himself never managed to do, which is to provide a natural law justification for private ownership that's thick and not this sort of thin seats in a theater analogy.
No, yeah, that's good. So my other question has to do with the limited government side of Locke's theory. Yeah. So, I mean, the sort of dime store version of Locke, right, on limited government is that, you know, the nature of government is such that we transfer certain kinds of limited rights to government, which then wields those rights. But at the same time, we retain certain rights, including inalienable rights that that the government doesn't legitimately have power over. That seems at a first glance sort of foreign to Cicero. I guess this returns in part to our sort of artificial versus natural discussion about government, but it doesn't seem like it would be something that, you know, in the spirit of Cicero, to think of, you know, government is something that's, you know, for these limited purposes only, and the people reserve kind of rights. But anyway, you know, disabuse me of that.
So it would be, because I myself was surprised to find myself reading Cicero in this way. He doesn't, at no point does Cicero raise the banner of limited government in those terms. But Cicero's vision of legitimate government is limited government. So, and it's limited by natural law. So there are things that a state cannot justly do because natural law is universally binding. And one of those things is to violate the principles of private property, for instance, on the grounds of the theater analogy, though, and not on the grounds that what you happen to own is yours by a deeper natural right. But you also have a right to your life. And you have a right to libertas. You have a right to freedom, which is a contested notion around and in Cicero scholarship. It's true that Cicero doesn't envision us having pre-political rights. And this is, again, where I think Locke massively innovates on Cicero and is probably drawing from other early modern thinkers, including possibly Hobbes. There's also movement in this direction from Grotius and Pufendorf. Cicero envisions the natural law to provide duties and obligations that we all have. It turns out that Cicero does have a theory of rights that emerges when you're in political society, and rights simply are the obverse side of duties and obligations. So in other words, this is a very modern, comprehensible vision of what a right is say I have a duty to give you something is to say you have a right to it. Or if you have a right to something, it is the same thing as to say I have a duty to respect it. So if you have a right to your life, the consequence of that for me is I have an obligation not to kill you, for instance. And so I do see Cicero's natural law theory as having, unrecognized by Cicero, access to a theory of rights if he had been able to think in that direction, which he does not, but that one could find a theory of natural rights very compatible with Cicero's thought. And when you do enter political society, that's when Cicero begins to actively describe people as possessors of rights. The Latin word is iuris or iures, which can mean both justice and rights. So that creates some interpretive confusion. But in some of the ways Cicero uses it to describe the well-functioning of a political society, there's no other way to describe it but to say he's talking about rights. So Cicero says one of the upshots of the principle, the egalitarian principles of natural law, is that no one may be harmed by the state absent certain emergency conditions of absolute dissolution of political society as a whole. No one can be harmed by the state without a trial. And Cicero describes that moral notion as having a right to a trial. Cicero says that the ordinary citizens have a ownership claim over the political community that's reflected in the ballot. And what he calls the ballot is a right. He says the citizens hold and have a right to vote, and that's actually, in fact, the guardian of their freedom is their right to vote. And so Cicero does have this notion of rights that I could have included this too in that great division of ancients and moderns, that most of the time we take rights to be a modern invention, and they're not. They can also be found in the Code of Roman Law, but the Code of Roman Law in part seems to be depending on Ciceronian concepts as well. So that's kind of way more to get into than I'm prepared to do here. But so Locke's notion of what a right is, without talking about natural light specifically, seems to fit reasonably well with Cicero's. Locke, in envisioning natural rights, rights we hold by nature, is something Cicero does not do. But when you look at what those rights are, they are the obverse side of what Cicero had claimed were the natural duties, which is to say, Cicero said, you have an obligation not to harm others, except in self-defense or in defense of others. You have an obligation not to interfere with their property, and you have an obligation not to command them, not to run their lives. And it's hard not to see the obverse side of those three things being a right to your life, a right to your property, and a right to your liberty, which are the fundamental Lockean rights. Again, I confine myself to saying that that's nothing more than incredibly suggestive in Locke's theory to see the Ciceronian valence of it. But it does strike me as incredibly suggestive that this something comes out of Cicero, at least in part, or possibly filtered.
Right. No, it's great. And it's very surprising. It's hard to imagine you could say something new about Locke, but there you have it, Mike. Good job. And that you have another chapter on the American founding, which we don't have time to go into, but I will just say that, you know, I also found it fascinating because this is another object of great scholarly inquiry, right? Exactly. Who are the main influences on the American, you know, intellectual influences on the American founders? And Cicero is usually not one that comes up. Do you have a thought as to why? You know, we talk about Locke, Montesquieu, you know, so forth, but Cicero rarely comes up.
Sure. I think part of it is that we're conditioned not to expect it by these great sweeping histories. So that, you know, the American founders are in the midst of this Enlightenment alleged break from the ancients. And so you're not expecting it on the one hand. Cicero isn't in, I think the Federalist Papers occupy such a central place in our imagining of the intellectual life or the intellectual thought of the founding, at least when on the constitutional side, maybe not the Declaration of Independence and Revolution side. And Cicero's general absence, at least explicitly from those, whereas while names like Montesquieu are being dropped with some, if not regularity, significance, helps a bit to explain it as well. But for me, it was a little bit, I think it was surprising until I realized that there was some justification for my book in explaining also Cicero, which is to say, I think Cicero is not, to the extent Cicero was read by historians of political thought and political theorists, he's read through one of those prisms. And thus I think the unique features of his thought are generally elided in one direction or another, such that you would need to be shown first that Cicero is, for instance, a theorist of consent and popular sovereignty, or has a theory of rights, or has a theory of property, to know where to look to see him in the American founding. And so that to me also explains it in part. But once you start looking, it is very hard to miss. So James Wilson especially is so, every time Wilson makes an argument that someone like you or me would expect to see, as John Locke says, something about natural rights or the right to property or the mixed regime or anything, almost every time it's Cicero, explicitly it's Cicero, which I found fascinating, but also delightful.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, recommend everyone take a look at that chapter, take a look at the whole book. But we're out of time. So Mike, thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.